Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is author and travel writer Peggy Henson. She will be sharing her international life of living more than 20 years in Yemen, Turkey, India, and Indonesia. Peggy and I will also be discussing her latest novel, Deadline Yemen. The book is the second in her Deadline Elizabeth Darcy mystery series. Good morning, Peggy. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm fine, Johnny. How are you?
Wonderful. It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. Deadline Yemen is a wonderful read. In addition to the exciting mystery, the book reveals an intriguing look at the cultural intricacies of Yemen, which in itself, I believe, is a wonderful, rich lesson. Congratulations.
I hope so. I hope so.
No question about it that you have done a beautiful work in writing and giving us a wonderful narrative tour of the country in many ways and the culture and so forth.
Well, I appreciate that.
Let us start by getting to know you a little bit. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
A quick
and we have the whole hour to do that too.
yeah. This show is 3 hours. No. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Moved west as soon as my father could get us moved, which was when I was 1 and a half. Grew up in Colorado. My father was a minister and a teacher and a principal. And he climbed mountains. He climbed all the 14,000-foot peaks in Colorado alone. He was quite an adventurer himself, and we lived a very nomadic life.
Mm-hmm.
Then finally we settled down long enough for me to go to high school in one place, which was Pruta, Colorado. And I went from there to Yankton College, which was a congregational school in South Dakota. Got a good scholarship there, and we happened to be Congregationalists, so I went there. And in 1962, when I was a senior in college, the notice came out that applications would be accepted for the Peace Corps. And so I didn't have the feeling that I had to stay in one place because I've never grown up with that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And so it immediately appealed to me. Immediately I put my application in. And so that was probably... And by that summer, was taking my first plane ride to University of Maryland, where we had training, and meeting wonderful group of with whom I'm going to get together in 2 weeks in Maine. We have a very close-knit group who went in 1962. We were the first group to Turkey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We were on Pan Am 1, I think, that went that direction in those days. And we had Turkey 1, Afghanistan 1, and Iran 1 aboard. Mm-hmm. They dropped us off serially.
Interesting. Very interesting. When did you discover you have a love for writing?
Oh, goodness. I always wrote. I just always wrote. I do not remember not writing. I remember the first poem that I actually wrote out, and I think my parents probably sent it around to relatives. I was in about the fifth grade. But my house, my life is full of folders and notebooks and back of envelopes. I've always written.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You joined the Peace Corps. How was life like in terms of living abroad? Were there many challenges?
Oh, yes. we were in a, one other volunteer and I were in a small town in, well, it was a provincial capital in the center of Anatolia. Life was very rigid and strict there, as we quickly learned. We were taken under the wing of the entire community, and women would come to the kitchen. This is how you cook this. This is how you do this. This is how you do Turkish coffee, and you must do everything in the right order when you entertain everybody for your gün, they called it the day, and after, you know, when you you were assigned and everybody came, and it was, yeah, absolutely chock full of challenge, and every, turned my life upside down, changed my life forever.
As I recall, at that time, there is some sort of a cultural revolution in itself in the United States in terms of the women are more progressive in terms of, hey, I'm not going to be in the kitchen. My position is out working and so forth. So how was that like in terms of going to countries that the women are in sort of in the traditional role as being the person in the kitchen and so forth?
Actually, that was not true in Turkey. there were as many, really, Ataturk had come, you know, when Ataturk founded Turkey, he insisted that it be on secular Western lines, and women were to do all the jobs that men do. And, well, maybe not all, you know, we still have those issues, but country, teaching was a very, a job that that a lot of women did, and so a lot of us had trained as teachers. We were about half and half, I think, women and men in our group, and I would think there were at least as many women as men in the teachers' lounge in Çankırı, Turkey.
Interesting.
So
did you have a choice to choose which country you go to?
No, well, if I did, I didn't exercise it. It was interesting because I had grown up with tales of my great aunt Mary, who was a missionary in the Balkans when the Balkans were in the Ottoman Empire and ending in 1920. And so there was sort of a feeling of Turkey. And I've just recently gone back to really explore that whole connection.
Very interesting. Tell me about your life with the Voice of America.
Well, I was one of the oldest interns at VOA. I had already lived in Turkey for 8 years, Yemen for 3 years, had done taught English as a second language various places. And the VOA did something that a lot of people did not. When you applied, they gave you a whole packet that you had to do, which included writing a newscast. Here's some stories, put them in the right order, and then voice the newscast, and then write a backgrounder, and so on. And I got the job, I was told, because they liked my voice. It was very exciting. I was 40 at the time and kind of at a big crossroads in my life. And I, all of a sudden, I was going out of teaching, which was which I always had viewed as something I could do as a wife, as a mother, as an adjunct to somebody else, and because I could do it anywhere, and I just suddenly was studying, was learning technical skills. You know, the intern year of internship, I did everything from directing to having voice lessons to, you know, news writing and all of that. So it was very, very exciting. I had a wonderful time at VOA.
Wonderful. Do you use your writing to express yourself in a public forum or to just entertain others?
Right now, well, if you call travel writing, and if anyone wants to look at my, that's a public forum, right? I mean, blogging.
Yeah.
And yeah, I would say that my travel writing is often specifically geared to education or sharing. I wouldn't say education. I would say sharing an experience. And my writing is too, in many ways. But I think that with both of them, I would say I'm trying to entertain as well. I think that you get the message across better when you're entertaining.
So true.
But there is an underlying message.
But you, when you were in the Peace Corps and so forth, and of course in with Voice of America, I presume, you seem to be gravitating towards the Middle East, and in some ways, of course, you did live some time in Indonesia as well. Were there specific things by then that you have discovered that you like or you like to pursue in this case in terms of wanting to know more about the world?
I experience that feeling every day, Johnny, and I just I'm particularly high on that at the moment because we just went to Egypt for 3 weeks, and it was so strange because people were saying, oh, you're going to Egypt, that's so dangerous, and, you know, Egypt is not dangerous right now. It has been in the last two or three years. It has been not a place that anyone could guarantee your safety. That's not really true, but people don't know it. And they and it was so exciting to just I just went out by myself all the time, and and my husband was working. He's an economist with the World Bank, so he was trying to work on a bank and with a team, and I was set loose. And I just had a wonderful time talking to everybody. Kind of the old journalist never dies.
They just fade away in some ways, correct?
Yeah.
Gracefully, that is.
Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
I'm happy for you. I think it's very exciting what you have done so far. And certainly you have reached a certain milestone with your novels. And that's quite fascinating. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. Were there difficulties in transitioning from writing as a journalist to writing as a novelist?
Well, I think almost every journalist wants to be a novelist. I mean, you always wish that you could get out of the box of hard, cold facts and getting them right and getting them in exactly the right order and, you know, and being sure you're up to date. Sure, it takes some transition. And at first I found myself rather... See, I've been fooling around with these books for years. I wrote the first draft of Deadline Istanbul while I was living in Indonesia. I wrote the first draft of Deadline Yemen while I was living in India, and I was 73 by the time I published these two books last fall. So it's not an easy process, but I had a lot of life going on at the same time, and it was interesting to me that I stuck with it. I really wanted to do it, and so I took some courses, and I... you know, I just kept going, and for some reason, finally got an agent, got a publisher, and I should say Wildside Publishers has been wonderful for me. They're a small press, and they allowed me to make a lot of my own choices, like letting my daughters wonderful paintings that she mm-hmm. did for the covers be, I could choose what I wanted. I could choose
yeah.
things exactly the way I wanted them. And that was very valuable to me.
Very interesting. So what is the motivation behind writing mysteries set in remote areas?
Well, first, what is the motivation in writing mysteries?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that I've always loved them. I mm-hmm. do not understand why, but there's nothing more relaxing and calming than a good murder mystery. I mean, ask anybody who loves Agatha Christie.
That's right.
And, or, you know, I don't understand it. Maybe mm-hmm. it's a way that we approach death, mm-hmm. which is the most frightening thing, and we approach it in a way that has a plot that usually, not always, but often, mm-hmm. the bad guy get it rather than really good people. And I don't know. So I always just loved mysteries. I loved Dorothy Sayers and Josephine Tay and I loved Mary Stuart. So I got hooked on mysteries. And I wanted to share the comfort that I get from reading a good mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I also loved Yemen. And mm-hmm. I loved Turkey, and I loved Indonesia, and I loved India. I've loved everywhere, and now I love Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just, I don't know how that came about exactly, except that I wanted, I also love Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm.
I love cats, and I do not like, I don't personally read thrillers that disturb or frighten me too much,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but I wanted to use in the case of Yemen, I had to delve into the issue of terrorism quite a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Terrorism, arms smuggling. People don't know that Osama bin Laden. This book takes place in 1997. At that mm-hmm. point, Osama bin Laden was living in Sudan. And he had many networks that he was working in Yemen. People don't also know that Osama bin Laden's father and grandfather came from Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, there is, as you know, there's a mm-hmm. honey network. Well, Osama mm-hmm. bin Laden actually had a honey network, and I believe that might still be operating a little bit,
mm-hmm.
where you can send illicit arms, drugs, all kinds of things
mm-hmm.
packaged with honey, and dogs can't smell it, people can't put their hands in, you know.
mm-hmm.
But so I decided to use that as part of the plot. So I just decided to throw mysteries, Yemen, Turkey, Islamic societies, because I happen mm-hmm. now to have lived in three of them,
yeah.
And cats. In Deadline Istanbul, there are a couple of chapters that are in the cat's voice, because the cat can go places people can't. Even Elizabeth Darcy can't go where the cat goes. So I decided to throw those all into a mix. And as you see, as you have, you've read it, I mean, you've mm-hmm. read one of them, it's a mix of
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
a comfort book in the sense that I don't think you come out terribly disturbed, but it's adventure. You're invited to go along with Elizabeth Darcy on adventures.
Right.
And she
right.
takes Jane Austen as her comfort cushion. She takes one mm-hmm. one Jane Austen book with in each book, and to go along. And at the same time, I think there's a lot of and this is something I really haven't figured out exactly where truth begins and ends, because mm-hmm. I have certainly changed some things. Now I have gone back to Yemen a number of times. The last mm-hmm. time was in 2008. So I know there are things that have changed since even since the plot in my book. Mm-hmm. And I acknowledge that in the introduction. I've given Sada an airport. Sada doesn't mm-hmm. have an airport, but mm-hmm. I needed an airport for my plot. So I gave Sada an airport. I hope that the underlying impressions one gets of that kind of society, a tribal society, a very Islamic society, mm-hmm. a traditional society, a very, actually a very tolerant society. I don't think mm-hmm. people understand that about Yemen. And it's I'm devastated at what's happening to Yemen right now.
Very interesting. Can you read a couple of paragraphs to kind of give us a sense of the voice for Elizabeth Darcy, your journalist protagonist?
Sure. I'll read you a little bit from. I can read from both if you wish later, but right now I'll read
sure.
you a couple of paragraphs from the beginning of Deadline Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
Starts with a quote from Freya Stark, who was a British journalist a British explorer, spy.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote an author who traveled around a lot in Yemen in the 1930s. The perpetual charm of Arabia is that the traveler finds his level there simply as a human being. 1997. It's a myth that a woman needs a male escort in the Middle East. My taxi driver treated me just as he would any man. He tried to cheat me. 50 rials, I asked in mock amazement, leaning into the window. I won't pay more than 30. My Arabic was rough, but within these parameters, understandable. The driver I'd selected from the line of jalopies adjusted his loose turban, shifted his wad of ghat to one side of his mouth, spat green juice onto the ground, and gestured for me to get in, a magnanimous act of compromise on the price. He didn't offer to help me, so I pushed my carry-on into the front seat and crawled into the plastic-covered back seat. The dashboard had fake fur all over it and looked like a poor ragged animal that had had a hard winter. Egyptian music whined from the radio. I didn't even look for a seatbelt.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Right there in itself, I grew up in Malaysia till I was 18. I was born in Malaysia. I was in Malaysia for 18 years before I come to the United States to go to college.
Uh-huh.
And basically, this is home for me now. In just that paragraph itself, you talk about the taxi driver chewing tobacco. In many ways, that's what it is. Or it's a form of
a
drug, in a
way.
It's actually
sort of narcotic named God.
It's a drug. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That reminded me of my grandmother. And I'm sure when you were in Indonesia, you've seen that, where they have this leaves that they could, that's right, and they can make it on their own and put it on the side of the cheek and,
and enjoy
it brings
it
back memories
hours.
In a way. Yes, it brings back memories from that perspective. And, of course, the
uh-huh.
art of bargaining, never pay the initial price that they tell you that they're going to charge you. So you have all that wonderful, wonderful, wonderful snapshot of how life is like in Yemen, and basically overseas, for that matter, in just one beautiful short paragraph.
Well, thank you. It's a way, I do think that there are ways to approach a culture
mm-hmm.
that help you get into it much easier. First of all, you have to do your research. Of course, you have to
yeah,
do your research.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So true. What make you choose the various characters for the book?
Oh, I have no idea. I my son was reading Deadline Yemen, and he called mm-hmm. me up and he said, "Is this autobiographical?" And I
yeah.
said, "Absolutely not, Jeff."
I said,
"Elizabeth Darcy and I have been working on our divorce package for years, and I certainly didn't have those. I wasn't falling over dead bodies, and I wasn't solving mystery than other than what was going, what was the government going to do next, and so on. The characters, most of the time, I could not tell you precisely where the characters come from.
Mm-hmm.
I had in Deadline Istanbul, I had one guy that was sort of in my mind, and his mannerisms and so on stuck with me, but I gave him a completely different character. He was a nice guy, and
mm-hmm.
you know, the person in Deadline Istanbul wasn't. and I don't know. I can't tell you exactly. I think it's sort of, I've known a number of Yemeni women,
mm-hmm.
and Halima is based on a group of them. You know, they can be very
yeah.
strong, very direct. Yemenis are very direct. And I loved having them as students when I was a teaching at the Yemen America Language Institute. Mm-hmm. Loved having them.
Interesting. How much information in the book is fact and how much of it is fiction? You certainly have a whole lot of facts in it. Having lived in Malaysia and understanding the Muslim cultures and so forth,
right.
and I guess not necessarily the religion itself, but just the overall culture,
mm-hmm.
I can relate to a lot of the facts being real. From your perspective, what's the balancing act here?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. As I said, I think that you take liberties. That's
mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm.
your right as an author. I would not respect myself as an author if I took liberties that gave a wrong impression
yeah.
of a country. I think that if there is an underlying motive in my writing these particular books, it might be that I'm trying to help people understand that people, even in a remote, unknown, now seemingly alien country like Yemen, people
mm-hmm.
are people.
Mm-hmm.
People exact. You can take a cross-section of Yemenis and you could take a cross-section of a community in Iowa or something, and you would have the same characteristics. Not externally, but the people are actually people. There are good people, there are bad people, there are interesting people, there are boring people.
Mm-hmm. So true. The government's philosophical approach to life and being may be different, but in the end, people are people.
People are people. And it doesn't matter what religion they are.
Correct.
It really doesn't. People do with religion what they wish to do.
Right.
And they can, you know, if whatever religion it is. I think there are people who take it to extremes, people who take it as dogma, and they're the only mm-hmm. ones that have the right answer. I like to break down that kind of barrier.
Yeah, and in many ways, too, overseas and places that you have been, I think you might agree with my comment here in the sense that in many cases, culture is religion, religion is culture. They are sort of intertwined with one another.
Totally, totally. And nowhere is this more evident than mm-hmm. in, let's say, Indonesia.
Right.
Where most of the country, the biggest islands are basically Muslim,
mm-hmm.
Not Bali, that's Hindu. But both of those islands I know well, and their religion is lying over the old traditions.
Right.
And at the earth goddess, the rice goddess, mm-hmm. the... there are in Bali. There are figures that are principal in religious ceremonies that no Indian Hindu has ever heard of.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that they might have the best example, but this is true in every culture.
Right. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about it is that you have a fresh perspective about respect, trust, which actually is their own authentic way of looking at things, their own personal branding. And I have an interesting question for you, is that while you had this opportunity over the last 20-odd years or so traveling in different places and living in different places, were you in a situation where you find yourself going on a spiritual journey of self-discovery?
I think that that's been true certainly since I joined the Peace Corps. Now, my 20 years have not been in the last 20 years.
Sure.
You know, I've been back in the States for a long time now, except for a lot of travel.
Mm-hmm.
I think life is a spiritual journey. And as you go into different cultures, you get asked very uncomfortable questions about yourself, about your mm-hmm. previously held beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that changed me. That changed me a lot. I know that I couldn't have gone from a little Colorado town and a tiny little South Dakota college to being very comfortable traveling around the world without the Peace Corps as an
mm-hmm.
opportunity. Now, young people have a lot more opportunities now to do that, and I would so encourage them. Well, Peace Corps is one option. There are lots of other ways to do it. I think even military people,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Although they tend to be somewhat kept in a box when they're
yeah.
in another culture, many of them come back with a new understanding. Not
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not
mm-hmm.
as many as Peace Corps.
So true. Well, you guys have to pretty much live the way the locals do.
Yes,
and
we
often
did.
The time
totally
you
did.
Are not sent to the most luscious places either. Contrary
no.
to right, contrary to the exchange student program where you kind of put together with a pretty good family and those kind of things, but the Peace Corps, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, they just in at least in our day, they
right.
we were dumped in. I remember we were put in a taxi from Ankara. Throw our bags in, throw our kitten in, because we'd already acquired a kitten in
mm-hmm.
in training. We had 3 weeks of training in Ankara. And so, and then
mm-hmm.
off we drove, getting car sick all the way on dirt roads. And we arrive in the town, and this little guy from the school is there to meet us. He says, "I have been waiting for hours." and but in Turkish, and all of a sudden you think, I don't know a word of Turkish. You know, we had been studying
yeah.
it intensively. I remember
yeah.
on the plane going over, as a matter of fact, over in my mind was one of the lines that we had to learn in Turkish and memorize and memorize and memorize. Cinema saat kaçta başlıyor, and I was saying, cinema start. What time does the cinema start? And saying, nobody is going to ever understand me if I say that.
Yeah.
But through 6 months after I was in total immersion in Çankırı, Turkey, I was crying out in Turkish in my sleep. I'm afraid. I was saying things like,
yeah.
sit down, close the window, don't talk. in Turkish, which isn't a very good recommendation for me as an English teacher, but I learned Turkish from them better than they learned English from me, I think.
How much of you is in the book?
Well, you know, no author can take himself or herself out of the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing, especially writing, creative writing, whether it's travel writing or whether it's not fiction.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of me. I desperately try to separate myself from the character Elizabeth
mm-hmm.
Darcy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. As I say, one of my own children thinks that she resembles me quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, she's going to express my innermost thoughts and
mm-hmm.
feelings and
mm-hmm.
the way I approach an adventure, let's say.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. What do you enjoy most about writing the series?
Well, it's very satisfying to at last. I really thought that I they would sit on the shelf or they would be in my computer. Then
mm-hmm.
it began to occur to me that my children don't even know my password to get into my computer. This thing would be, all this writing would be locked in that computer
mm-hmm.
and it would never be seen. So when I really got going, about a couple of years ago, I really began to apply myself to thinking about publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And because I've always just written because I love writing, and it was very satisfying to start really structuring, really thinking about what does go into a novel. Learning,
mm-hmm.
I learned a lot by writing
mm-hmm.
novels.
Mm-hmm.
I also took courses. I took some wonderful courses and went to conferences and heard people talking about it.
Interesting. Now I'm putting you on the spot. What have you learned from the different countries? So let's start out with Yemen first, and then we'll go down the line to the various countries that you have traveled. If there's one thing that you can take, something that's unique and special that each country had contributed to.
Whoa. To me.
Yes.
To my spiritual journey.
And whatever that may be.
Yemen gave me everlasting mystery.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get to the end of it. So I learned that I could never get enough of Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a complex, fascinating place. I love the people. Turkey has everything. Turkey is a fantastic place to live. If my husband spoke Turkish and my children would come in to see me, I would probably live in Turkey. Indonesia. Oh, goodness. Well, in Indonesia, I learned a lot about the Minangkabau, who will play a major role in Deadline Indonesia. And you probably do know about Minangkabau.
Mm-hmm.
You're from Malaysia.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
This wonderful matrilineal Muslim society. I got very into that when I was in
mm-hmm.
Indonesia and went visited villages there and
mm-hmm.
I still have very good Indonesian friends who are Minangkabau.
Mm, interesting.
So
very rich in
tradition. And I have very good Turkish friends. I have very good friends in Yemen.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. And of course India. No,
yeah.
That's what it's all about is sharing lives, sharing experiences, and enriching other people as they enrich you.
Mm-hmm. So now let's flip it the other way around. What do you feel was your greatest contribution to Yemen and the rest of the countries?
Oh, my goodness. I hope I made something, did something. Well, I let them know, I mean, in the case of both Turkey and Yemen,
mm-hmm.
less so in Indonesia and India, I was often the first American people had had a chance to get to know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I was able to get across to some of them that, in
mm-hmm.
fact, Americans are regular people, too. We aren't the prototypes from the movies.
Right.
You know, we are regular people. And, of course, I hope I taught some English.
Mm-hmm.
And I Well, there have been lasting effects of continuing communications with people, answering a lot of questions about my feelings, which I try to get across. I cannot speak for America, but I am an American,
right,
through and through, and so they get a chance to understand me a little bit.
That's wonderful. Real life, real situation. When you peel away all the various layers of the political side of the equation, and in some ways religion and so forth, you find that, you know, we're all people. And we
right.
just live our lives differently at different parts of the world.
Right.
But we share the same
right.
values for ourselves
mm-hmm.
as well as for, most importantly,
right.
for our children.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Hope, loyalty,
mm-hmm.
love. You know, I mean, these are constants.
Right, right.
Fear.
And we all have fears. And so if we look through the various lens in terms of hope, opportunity, success, love,
mm-hmm.
and in so many ways, fear can be a wonderful motivating factor to promote a better
sure.
understanding.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
And I have a fantastic yoga teacher who says, you know, mm-hmm. obstacles are not in the path. Obstacles are the path. and I have found that to be very, very true.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, do you have a bunch of batiks from Indonesia? They make
I
wonderful
do.
Batiks out there.
I do. And I actually wore a batik shawl in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
when my husband and I went to a fundraiser for a presidential candidate named
mm-hmm.
Barack Obama in our area. And I wore
mm-hmm.
the batik shawl, and he immediately looked at it and he said, "That's a nice batik." And we spoke a couple of words of Indonesian to each other.
Interesting.
So that was a lovely moment.
Yes. They have wonderful batik sarongs. Like Malaysia as well. And so those wraps are just beautiful.
Yes.
And if I recall correctly, the Indonesian batiks have the Garuda bird on them because that's their national bird, like what we have our American bald
eagle. Some of them do. They have various fantastic individual designs.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful art. It is a wonderful art.
Wonderful. What would you like your readers to gain from reading Deadline Yemen?
I would like them to say, gee, if the circumstances change a little bit, so the State Department isn't saying, do not go there, leave if you are there, I would really like to go to Yemen. I've had some friends around the world saying, I never thought I needed to go to Yemen, but now I do.
Yeah.
I would hope that they could see that people would say, oh, okay, every country has good and bad, and Yemen is no different. But people are fighting for good in whatever country they're in, including Yemen.
Right, so true. Will this book help to bring a better understanding among the different cultures and societies in some ways?
Hope so. That would certainly be, that I would say as a Peace Corps volunteer, as an English teacher, as a Voice of America reporter and correspondent, those were always the goals. If we understand each other, it's hard to hate each other.
Right. So true. You recently made a trip to Egypt, as you had mentioned earlier in the show.
Mm-hmm.
What are your impressions of the Middle East today?
Well, the Middle East is a mess, but obviously. and for so many reasons. I mean, it's tragic. I can't even bear to watch the news. Syria, Iraq, Gaza. I mean, it's a horrible mess, and I'm not sure the United States has helped at all. But I feel that we have to keep trying. It's interesting about Egypt. Nobody knows that Egypt is a perfect destination right now. The new president, Sisi, yes, it was the military takeover of a government, the Muslim Brotherhood government. But what has happened is, and I went around asking everybody. I mean, I asked taxi drivers, how do you feel about the hike in fuel prices? And they were uniformly, yes, somebody has to do something, and maybe Sisi can do it, and we're going to give him a chance.
Right.
And they and because Sisi is a military man, the military is strongly behind him. The military is in control of security now, which means that I called up one Egyptian friend and said, would I be safe walking around on the streets of Cairo and getting in a taxi with my bad Arabic and going to a, off to the old parts of the city? And she said, Peggy, nobody is safer in Egypt right now than a foreign woman. I would, and foreigners generally, we receive nothing but the kindest reception. And it was Ramadan, and it was July.
Sure.
And people were fasting. People could not have been nicer to us. The hotels are still all set up. Want all the luxuries. You can get good bargains. Tourists are not there yet, so you can actually see the pyramids without the tourists.
It's like going to Disney World during the off-season.
It's wonderful right now. It's wonderful.
Fantastic.
People are missing out if they don't go.
Yeah, fantastic. Why is there so much misunderstanding between the Muslim-dominated society and those in Europe and in the United States?
Boy, that's the millions on millions dollar question, isn't it, Johnny?
Yeah.
I think that first, I don't know. I don't know what has happened exactly. 9/11 was a very serious breach, created a very serious breach between the West and Muslim society. And in that sense, the terrorists won.
Yeah.
You know, they've created a lot of suspicion of Muslims in the Western world. They are gathering recruits through various methods, very destructive. I don't know, but I think that the fact that we don't understand each other is one of the main problems.
Right. On the other hand, too, I believe that it's an internal issue among the Muslims themselves. With respect to 9/11, they have to resolve within themselves in terms of having the good and bad within themselves to address the issue. That's an internal issue in a way, because you can't have someone within your own society hijack your beliefs, your culture, because culture is religion, religion is culture.
Right.
Having been from Malaysia, that's how I feel about that. It's not an external issue.
That is true, except that we are not using drones in Malaysia.
Oh, certainly. I understand that.
I think that you are absolutely right. The general reaction across the Muslim world was horror at 9/11.
Yeah.
And the West's reaction and I fear that the use of drones in Yemen has probably manufactured more terrorists than it has killed.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that you can fight terrorism. You can't fight that kind of fundamentalist fanaticism with guns and with bombs. We have to make sure that they can't fight us with them too.
it's a very tricky thing. Right. And it's very difficult to address the issue because in the sense that when the society in itself does not take care of their own, then outsiders will have to come in. And that's where it gets convoluted in terms of how do we address those issues. But that's, of course, another show, another time.
Yeah, it sure is. Maybe Islam is, maybe we all need a new reformation.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
where we redefine things and say, wait a minute,
precisely.
We got off the track here. Let's get back.
Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Okay, well, to keep up with me, you can go to my website, which is www.peggyhansonauthor.com. And that's Hansen with an O. And for the books, I'd like to just put a little plug in for my Edgar Award-winning local bookstore, Mystery Loves Company, which is now located in Oxford, Maryland. Kathy Herrig has been doing a lot of selling of my books for me. They can also be gotten on Kindle. They can be gotten on Amazon and in any of your local, if you ask your local bookstore, they can get it.
Well, wonderful. How has writing Elizabeth Darcy Mysteries impacted you personally?
Well, I think it's given me a very interesting structure because it requires a lot of discipline to write something that holds together. And I've learned so much. I think that learning about writing, examining my writing, re-examining my writing, re-examining my writing has been a very, very good experience for me. And then publishing has just been wonderful. And Wildside Press, authors out there who are interested, give them a try. They do mystery, fantasy, and mostly those.
Wonderful. What is next for you then?
Well, I'm working on two different books right now. One is Deadline Indonesia, which will feature a lot of knowledge about the Minangkabau West Sumatran culture. Mixed in with, oh goodness, you know, a lot of some scandals and that some people may find a little familiar if they've lived in Indonesia. And Elizabeth, of course, is going to be in danger. You know that if you've read anything about her. I'm also starting a new series, which I hope to finish the first book in within a year, and that is the Mary Matthews Missionary Sleuth series, featuring my great aunt that I mentioned, who went to the Balkans in 1888, taught and led a girls' school there until 1920. So she was in the Balkans during the end of the Ottoman Empire, during the First Balkan War, the Second Balkan War. She was the only American to stay in her town, which was being bombarded by the Germans for 2.5 years during World War I. And she wrote daily diaries. And I've given all the originals to of her, and she had a camera. Somebody gave her a camera in 1903. So I have a lot of information, and the first book is going to be called something like Unholy Death on the Orient Express. because Aunt Mary took the Orient Express in 1888.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Very, very interesting. As an accomplished author and writer, obviously, what three things can you suggest to new writers to fine-tune their craft?
Okay. I would say, first, write what you love. Don't fool around with anything else. You're doing this for love. Remember that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Take out all the adverbs and put a conflict on each page. Make sure you have some kind of a conflict on each page.
Interesting. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. add several cups of each of these things. Explore.
Okay.
Reach out. Learn. Don't be afraid to burn bridges. You can build new ones. Add joy to one person's life per day. Care for your friendships and relationships even better than you do your delicate houseplants or your cats. Listen to people. Put your own oxygen mask on first so you can help others. Move, breathe, stretch, do yoga. Forgive everyone. Resentment hurts only you. And remember, any moment could be your last. Every moment is precious.
Wonderful.
And I think you summed this up on your website, too. And you didn't say it in these words, but I would say the answer to the universe is love.
That's right. Thank you so much. That's a wonderful recipe for living. And thank you for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio.
Thank you, Johnny.
You're welcome. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Paramahansa Jagadish. He is an American-born master healer, teacher, and spiritual leader with more than 40 years of deep and concentrated spiritual practice rooted in Eastern yogic and Tibetan Buddhist traditions. He has dedicated his life to spreading spiritual wellness by awakening others' hearts to experience divine grace. His level of self-realization, combined with his lifetime study and service, distinguishes him as the healer of healers. Paramahansa and I will be discussing The Prayer Project. It is a unique book, a toolbox of prayer, which illuminates the power of prayer and how the impact prayer can be good for you personally. The book also provides a brief perspective on how the world's predominant religions and culture enjoy approaching prayers from their own perspective. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Peggy, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.